It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest is an African-American journalist who recently returned to his alma mater to find out why so many students, like him, never make it to graduation.
You know, it's the graduation rate for black students at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee is 19% within 6 years, and the overall graduation rate isn't much better either, at 40%. So he wants to know what's behind this and what can be done to boost those rates.
Joining us is Jamal Abdul-Alim. He's a freelance writer who specializes in covering higher education and an education journalism fellow at Columbia University. His piece, Dropouts Tell No Tales, appeared in this month's Washington Monthly. Jamal, welcome to Central Time.
Good evening.
Well, Dropouts Tell No Tales, it really captures what you're looking at because there are a lot of dropouts and we don't know their stories. And is that why you tried to track this issue?
Yeah, that was one of the reasons for my return visit to UWM. The statistic was cited in an earlier piece that appeared in Washington Monthly. And quite frankly, I was kind of taken aback by the statistic. But at the same time, I know that UWM is a good institution. It served me well. And so I figured, me being familiar with the institution and having graduated there, that I would be uniquely suited to go and explore some of the reasons behind the numbers. I always favor the qualitative over quantitative.
And you look at some of the different explanations as to why UWM has this graduation issue. One argument you heard a lot is that UWM is a school that admits most people who apply to it. It's supposed to be inclusive, and in a lot of cases, maybe those students aren't ready for college. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Yeah, it's something to point out, but I think there's a danger if we get into excuse making. One of the professors that I quoted in the story mentioned that, if a university admits students, that it has an obligation to, make sure that they have a reasonable shot at getting out, with a degree. And if that's not taking place, then there's some type of shortcoming. And I think it behooves the institution to do some serious soul searching and also, to look at some systemic issues to see what, if anything, can be done to improve the rates.
And you look at, briefly in your article, you talk about other institutions that have similar admission policies but better graduation rates.
Right. So UWM, when you look at averages, they come out like on the low end. So that's, problematic in and of itself. So clearly, if UWM is below average, then, that means they're nowhere near the high flyers. So, the point behind pointing that out is that, there's a lot of room for growth.
What was it like as an alumnus of UWM to go back and try to track the story of the students who were, they're in the boat now that you were in as a freshman some years back?
Yeah, so in many ways, it felt, the same as when I was there. The campus had the same feel. I went to a place that's kind of known as Little Africa because of the number of black students that hang out there. But I guess one of the differences is that, now I was going there, kind of on this investigative mission, whereas when I was in school, it was kind of like do what it takes to get out and move on. And so, it was just kind of a eye-opening experience. I never imagined that I would be covering higher education as a reporter. It's not something that I set out to do, something that just kind of ended up doing, especially when the Obama administration announced some very ambitious college completion goals. And so, in a sense, I kind of felt like a responsibility to come back to UWM and explore what was going on there and some ways that the school might be able to improve its completion rates.
Well, one thing you do mention in the article, when you were in school, you had a sense of mission. You weren't necessarily going to cover higher education, but you wanted to come out and be a journalist.
Right.
Is that part of what got you through, and maybe somebody else without that sense of where they were going might not make it?
In all honesty, I would dare say that's the only thing that got me through. Some listeners may remember back when Milwaukee was a two-newspaper town, the Milwaukee Sentinel and the Milwaukee Journal. I used to work at the Sentinel. And they made it clear that even though, I had good skills and I could write, I had won a contest and things of that nature, So they hired me as a freelancer, you know, when I was still in college and even as a part-time reporter. But they made it clear that without a degree, that there would be no full-time job. And so I took that seriously. And that served as an incentive for me to go ahead and do what it took to get through school. One thing I would add along those lines is that the students that I met that, you know, had achieved success and had gone on to careers, they kind of had a similar experience. You know, they had this mission that was, you know, beyond just a degree. The degree was like a means to an end. So it seems to me that one of the most important things that can be added to the mix in terms of, you know, improving completion rates is for somehow students to get, you know, that objective beyond college, because then the degree just becomes a means to an end rather than an end of itself.
Well, you know, I was a white middle-class college student, and I knew a lot of people in the same position, and a lot of people didn't know what the heck they wanted to do when they got out of college, but still graduated anyway. What's different about the situation, say, facing an African-American student from Milwaukee at the UWM that maybe makes it harder to muddle through than it was for my peers?
Right. And so, you know, I used to teach as an adjunct at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and I saw students, you know, of all races and ethnicities, you know, struggle to get through school, you know, working, you know, a job or sometimes two jobs. And so these struggles are quite common, as evidenced in, you know, UWM's overall graduation rate of 40%. But I think one difference with African-American students might lie in the public schools that they attend at the K-12 level. And so if you see, as you do in Milwaukee, you know, schools struggling at the K-12 level, then it only stands to reason that those problems are going to manifest at the post-secondary level.
And one hurdle you come back to a lot in your piece related to that is the math issue. Do you get the sense that a lot of people in this situation are coming in without the math skills to pass the math requirements at the university?
Yeah, and so, in fact, you know, I kind of went there with the theory that that was one of the main factors because I struggled with math myself. And, you know, I think I might have withdrawn twice, and then I actually failed college algebra at one point. And I ultimately passed it by taking a course at MATC. So my own experience let me know that, you know, hey, this problem is probably quite widespread. And so I had an experience when I went to UWM as a journalist, you know, for this story that pretty much confirmed that theory. You know, I had a chance to not really review the transcripts, but to kind of get someone to take a look at transcripts of students who had left the institution. And in 3 out of 5 cases, the math requirement had not been met. And so I think that shines a lot of light on the fact that, you know, getting through math is one of the most serious stumbling blocks for students at UWM. And to kind of put a face or, you know, an actual person with this, you know, there's a fellow journalist that I quote in the story who's in this situation. Her name is Shakira Robinson. And, you know, she mentions how she completed, you know, all of the university requirements, but she struggled with completing college math. And so, you know, here we have someone who's, you know, ready in every respect, but is just struggling with this one thing. So, you know, both the quantitative as well as the qualitative data that I gathered for this story tends to point to, you know, math being a serious problem at UWM, at least completion of math, that is.
So UWM can't solve the school issue in Milwaukee, the public school issue or charter school issue in Milwaukee, but what can they do to help the math problem? Is it a matter of helping with remedial math tutoring, or is it don't accept the students until they've taken remedial math? Don't get them in the door until they're ready for that requirement.
Yeah, so there's a number of things that can be done, and in some sense, UWM is doing it, doing one of those things. One is this Summer Bridge program. You know, their own, I don't have the statistics handy, but basically, you know, students who participate in the Summer Bridge program where they can, you know, knock out some of the math or at least prepare for some of the math that they'll be required to take at the college level. They tend to do better than those who just, you know, go throughout the summer and then wait until they actually, you know, start their freshman year. So that's one thing. There's also some other programs throughout the nation that have had some better success in the area of remedial math. One is known as QuantWay, and then also StatWay. These are programs run by the Carnegie. I want to make sure I get this right. There's two Carnegies. This is the one that deals with the advancement of teaching. And so they've been able to kind of like triple their completion rates in remedial math with these programs. And they take kind of like a different approach to it. You know, they got kind of like this can-do attitude to help students overcome math anxiety. And then also a lot of the applications are a lot more practical. So, you know, I don't want to stand as one who is endorsing this program or that program, but, you know, I've seen enough, especially covering higher education in D.C., to know that, hey, there's initiatives out there. And if UWM would just kind of like look for them and, you know, see what's working and then incorporate what works at UWM, I think it'll make a difference. And to the university's credit, they do have, at least they told me when I was there, that they had hired kind of a coordinator whose job is going to be to kind of like look throughout the nation and see what's working and try to bring back some of those ideas to UWM.
We're talking with Jamal Abdul-Alim about the African-American dropout rate at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. And we'll take your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think can be done to boost the graduation there and elsewhere for African-Americans or maybe other students who get in and face unique challenges? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Or maybe you are a university administrator working on this very problem. 800-642-1234 or send us an email at talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We continue our discussion now with Jamal Abdul-Alim about African-American graduation rates being quite low, he says, at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, similar challenges elsewhere in the state and the country. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this problem firsthand? Do you think there are solutions out there? You can also send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll go to the phones now. We have John on the line in Madison. John, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today.
What do you think about this?
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense. Fortunately, I work for somebody in the African-American community right now that works on education issues and things like that, but I was actually in a remedial program at UW-Milwaukee called the Student Support Services. It was part of the TRIO program, and luckily enough, in my 4 years at UWM, I was able to be a student worker in that program. And you know, I think one of the biggest things, I was one of the few white students that was in there, but I saw the kind of work that they were doing there. There were only three advisors, and, you know, compared to other places on campus, it was incredible because they only had, you know, a ratio of like 150 to 200 students per advisor in this program, as opposed to other colleges on campus where, you know, if you're in the Letters and Science College, you have one advisor to help you through your 4 years, you know, and they have 1,000 or more caseload of students they work with. So, you know, I think that was extremely beneficial, too, to have that one-on-one relationship and, you know, with an academic advisor, you know, that you're required to meet with your first three semesters on campus. And I took the bridge program that you were discussing earlier when I was going into my freshman year at UW-Milwaukee, and, you know, it was incredible. It was just incredible. You know, math was never my strong suit, and so I was very fortunate, I thought, to be in that program. And
John, thanks
a lot.
Thanks a lot for sharing that perspective, Jamal. That kind of student support, a closer relationship with academic advisors and counselors, is that part of the solution, do you think?
Yes, most definitely. You know, some of the students I spoke, UWM is notable in the sense that it has kind of like this culturally specific advising system for those who want it, at least in letters and science. And I myself took advantage of that. And, you know, many of the students I spoke with said that one-on-one touch, you know, being able to foster a relationship with the advisor where they didn't feel like a number or a statistic was crucial to their success at UWM.
Now, you tell, at the beginning of your article, you tell kind of a heartbreaking story going in and seeing the file cabinet labeled close to graduation. It's the records of black students who were credits away from graduating before they dropped out. And it might be easy to say, you're that close, why couldn't you finish? But it's harder than that for them. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think as I alluded to earlier, in just about at least three out of five cases, you know, it was the math requirement. And, you know, I myself, I could have been one of those students. You know, I struggled with math, and were it not for MATC, you know, the class that I took there, who knows what would have taken place. You know, going forward, I think it's interesting to note that, you know, in the conversation I had with the chancellor, you know, he spoke of basically teaming up with MATC and kind of letting them handle some of the remediation and, you know, helping the students along who need to complete, you know, college level algebra in order to, you know, reap more success in that area. You know, the idea being that, you know, UWM is more focused on research and that's its strong suit, whereas MATC might be better suited to deal with the students who are in need of remediation.
Yeah, earlier we touched on the issue of that sense of a lack of direction. You had your eyes on journalism there, but a lot of students don't have that. What can be done to foster that sense of direction to say, hey, there's light at the end of the tunnel and there's a path you're on?
Yeah, I think we should really not underestimate the power that one day can make in the life of a student at the K-12 level. And what I mean by that is, you know, with me, for instance, you know, there was a person who came from UWM and spoke about the journalism program, and that's what made me decide to pursue it. One of the other students I spoke with who graduated with a degree in architecture and actually went on to get a graduate degree in architecture, he spoke about a career day speech where an architect came into the classroom, I think he was in like third or fifth grade, and said, hey, I get paid to draw pictures. And that just blew his mind. His name is Nick Robinson. He's one of the students that I interviewed in the story. And so ever since, you know, he came in contact with that architect, his thing was, I'm going to become an architect and I'm going to do whatever it takes. And since that involved, you know, college education and certain math courses, then, you know, he did what had to be done to get through those courses. So never, ever underestimate the power of, you know, being able to reach a student, you know, early in their career and exposing them to different career options, because you never know what might capture their fancy and then ignite them and give them the energy to go and do what it takes to get to that point.
Is there any kind of effort to provide mentors, maybe alumni who've been in that same situation and came out the other side?
Yeah, in fact, the campus did mention some mentoring, kind of like student-on-student mentoring, and I think they're reaping some benefits in that regard. But with respect to alumni, you know, just so I went to my first alumni meeting earlier this year, and I in D.C. when I was still there, and there's another one coming up in New York that I plan to attend next week. So, you know, I think maybe alumni such as myself, you know, we're going to have to take a more active role in this if we care about the institution that that got us to where we are. And if we want it to be better, I think, you know, maybe we're going to have to take some leadership and say, what can we do? How can we serve as mentors? How can we support the concept of mentoring to get more students through?
You mentioned a couple of the initiatives that UWM's chancellor said he is going to take. He hopes to increase the graduation to 50%, I think that's overall, in the next 5 to 7 years. Are you optimistic with the things you've talked about and other initiatives that could happen?
Yeah, when I speak with members of his administration, you know, and if they got some new blood, you might not hear it. They might not be in the highest positions, but they've got some new blood. And, you know, when I hear the things that they're talking about pursuing, and especially when I hear about them wanting to see what's working in other parts of the nation and then bringing that back to UWM, I'm definitely optimistic. You know, sometimes I think Milwaukee is a little bit separated from the rest of the nation. You know, sometimes there's just this, you know, if someone travels, it's like, why are you traveling? They get all kind of beef, you know, just for going and exploring other ideas. And I think we have to actually foster getting out of Milwaukee and seeing what people are doing in other parts of the nation and then bringing back what works, especially if we have a problem. You know, I'm sure we don't want to be known as the institution, you know, with the below average graduation rate. But in order to turn things around, we have to be willing to look for ideas outside of, you know, just there on Lake Michigan.
Just a few seconds left. Despite those below average graduation numbers we've been talking about, is UW-Milwaukee a good school?
Most definitely. And in fact, one of the reasons I wanted to do this story was to point that out. You know, it's an excellent institution. And I'm resistant to the push to, you know, judge an institution solely by its graduation rate. I do think there is merit in looking at the graduation rate, but to look only at the graduation rate, I think it does a disservice not only to the institution, but to the many students such as myself who could benefit from it.
Jamal, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Jamal Abdul-Aleem is a writer, a journalism fellow, education journalism fellow at Columbia University, and a UW-Milwaukee graduate. We've got a link to his piece, Dropouts Tell No Tales, on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, Russia's president made his case on Syria to the American public in the New York Times, and we'll find out why.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our next installment of Curious Wisconsin. This week, we explore a mystery in Ripon and search for the town's mystery cave.
But first, if you open your New York Times to the opinion section today, you may have noticed an unusual contributor to the paper, Vladimir Putin.
The Russian president took his message on Syria directly to us, the American people. He's calling on the U.S. to avoid using force against Syria. He says if the U.S. and Russia can work together on this issue, could pave the way to cooperation on other things.
Joining us now to talk about that piece and where relations between the two countries go from here is Lisa Baglione. She's professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University. Lisa, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Well, tell us about this op-ed. Why do you think that Putin chose now to write it?
Well, the president was in a difficult situation. He wanted to act, and it was clear that the public was not favoring a strike against Syria, and that the Congress wasn't supporting him either. And so this was an opening for Putin to, in a sense, appeal over the heads of appeal over the head of Obama to the American public, and also to try to appeal to the world public to try to stop any kind of violent action against Syria, strike against Syria, and achieve for Russia some positive outcomes, which makes he's increased his prestige, and also is helping his ally Syria avoid a bloody confrontation.
Now, you could see this piece, I think, in a couple of ways. You could see it as an aggressive move that's sort of designed to show up the Obama administration, or you could see it as maybe a move designed to give the U.S. a diplomatic exit strategy on Syria. How do you read it?
Well, if you look at this and say, does Putin have ulterior motives, I would say certainly. And some of them are not in line with U.S. strategic interests. But I do think that what he's done here is give the U.S. an opening, give the U.S. a lifeline. Getting authorization for a strike from Congress was not and is not guaranteed for the president. Now, the president has said he would act even without that authorization because if he feels that this was so important for U.S. national security interests. But the public isn't behind him either. And he gave a good speech the other night, at least to his supporters in Congress. They were more reacted to it positively. But still, it's a tough sell. So what Putin does is gives Obama the opportunity to move forward with a diplomatic solution, which can also achieve American foreign policy goals. And those include strengthening the Chemical Weapons Convention, putting the UN back into the picture, and in addition, showing the Muslim world we're very close to this 9/11 anniversary, showing the Muslim world that the U.S. is not simply willing to use force against Muslim populations. So all of these are really important, I think. And in that way, Russia and the United States' strategic interests at times do overlap.
And yet there are critical sections, certainly, of this op-ed piece, the first part of it being that the U.S. needs to abide by United Nations law, otherwise the United Nations is undermined and world safety is undermined. And then at the end of the piece, he moves toward looking at American exceptionalism and pointing a critical finger at that and saying that the U.S. should not think of itself as exceptional. It's a very strong way to end the piece. How should the Obama administration digest those two critiques?
I guess I would advocate that the Obama administration think about this as the Kennedy administration approached something during the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which when Khrushchev wrote, first he wrote a telegram to the administration providing an out to the crisis, and then later there was a follow-up communication which was much harsher, and the administration chose to ignore what it didn't like, and I think the administration should ignore what it doesn't like. Putin's trying to make some points too, score some points. I would ignore it. Putin also says that in one place that the relationship between Obama and Putin reveals a growing trust. Well, we know that's not true, but we should grab what is worthy and move forward with it. Putin is trying to also make appeals and win an audience and win points, but that doesn't. I don't think that should keep us from pursuing what ultimately, and this is my opinion, works best for the country and actually for the administration at this point, because the administration doesn't have the support of the public. The administration is going to have to fight a huge battle with Congress and really go all out to win the support of even those who normally are its advocates. And this fight will weaken Obama. And I do believe that Putin has a point, that even though it's ironic that it's coming from him, he's not exactly an advocate of international law and international organization, but this administration actually is typically and has been from the beginning one that talks about the importance of strengthening international institutions. So I would say that the president and his administration should move forward ignoring those negatives and seeing that as just the price of Putin's posturing.
Well, even if you see the piece as, you know, a benign diplomatic sally, there's still a bone of contention embedded in all of this, in that Putin goes so far as to say that the chemical weapons were used by the opposition in Syria and not the Syrian government. Does that paint this whole op-ed in a different light?
No, I mean, as I looked at it, I thought that Putin, in that op-ed, he makes some worthy points, and he puts forth some half-truths or distortions. I don't think that that's surprising from President Putin. That's not surprising. But what is a positive is that the outcome can be that Syria, which has an enormous stockpile of chemical weapons, gets them under international control. This happens without the United States virtually unilaterally, but, you know, the French will come along and some others will come along, but using force without the support of the UN, of the international community, and frankly, the American public. And, you know, it's very interesting that Putin makes that point that that in the United States, we typically expect the Congress to agree and the people to agree. But it's not there. And I think the administration should not underestimate how important it is to have that support.
Lisa, not that it necessarily matters, but do you think that Vladimir Putin actually wrote this?
I would doubt it. I would doubt it.
Who would write it for him?
Well, he's going to have a large circle of advisors that would be helping him on this. And I'm sure Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, would be involved. And I'm sure, you know, some of these points he can make. But I would think that this comes from a committee, and it's very well crafted, and it very much speaks to Americans, like you said, and it was politically, from our perspective, in terms of trying to reach to the American public, it's not going to play well here that he is critical of American exceptionalism. That, in the president's speech, is exactly what he needed to try to reach our public. So this tells us that that President Putin was not simply trying to talk to the United States, but he is making an important statement to the world, and many of these points are going to resonate with the rest of the world, and particularly with the Muslim world.
How do we see the Obama administration reacting so far to this, and how do you expect them to react?
Well, I think the president reacted well. I mean, when you consider that this was a last-minute proposal planned just before his big speech that was going to ask for the use of force, and then the president backed down from asking for the authorization for the use of force, but keeps that in his pocket. I think the administration has done a good job in saying we'll pursue this, but we will continue to consider the use of force if it is necessary. Because in the end, what the administration wants—I mean, the administration needs to, because of the red line comment, it needs to take a stand on the chemical weapons use, and it has strategic interest in doing that. And Putin's plan or the diplomatic possibility allows us to achieve that goal without force. And if that's possible, then great. And again, it will only strengthen the Chemical Weapons Convention as well as international organizations, which is something that this president and his administration have said for a long time they want to do.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome. It was my pleasure.
We've been talking to Lisa Baglioni, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia.
Coming up next, we'll go on the hunt for Ripon's Mystery Cave in our Curious Wisconsin segment.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's time for Curious Wisconsin now, and this week we head to Ripon, Wisconsin, to try and find out what might be hiding deep below the town's downtown. And we're putting the call out to you right now, too. If you have an idea for Curious Wisconsin, something you've been wondering about here in the Badger State, you can let us know on our Facebook page, and we'll try to find the answer for you. You can also call our hotline. It's 855-683-5422. That's 855-683-5422.
Years ago, a search for something called the Ripon Mystery Cave got underway, and of course, we love a good mystery, so we called up Craig Tebun to help us out.
Craig is the executive director of Ripon Main Street Incorporated, and Craig, welcome to the show.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So give us some of the background here. If you could tell us about the Breadbasket Bakery and how that launched this mystery.
Yeah, well, I came to Ripon back in 1992, and almost from that the first day, store owners and history buffs, they were all mentioning that there was an underground cave below Ripon, and so we started to ask some questions and talk with building owners and found out that it was probably there was an entrance beneath the old Breadbasket Bakery. So when unfortunately there was a fire in that building, I think in 1999, and the bakery closed, which then gave us an opportunity to do some exploring. And we were dealing with years of folklore, and what we found was very similar to what old-timers had been talking about.
And before we get into how you got digging in there, what was the human history of this the underground passage? What were the rumors and the folklore you heard about it?
Well, there's been rumors that it was used for Underground Railroad, which some of our local historians have disputed, because they've always mentioned that fugitive slaves probably would have went up the coast of Lake Michigan rather than cutting through all of the counties and the territories that may or may not have been friendly to fugitive slaves. There were other rumors that this was a place used during Prohibition and a place where illegal gambling and illegal drinking took place. So there were a few of those kinds of things, and one of the rumors was that, you know, this was below the basement of this building, and that there was a dome large enough to turn a team of oxen around. Hmm. And what we've found leads to believe that folklore is credible.
So tell us what you found when you first went down there and how you actually got at it.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, we ended up working with the Wisconsin Speleological Society, the WSS, and just started exploring in this basement by drilling test holes with concrete drills. And we found a void below part of the basement. So knocked out the floor and started digging, and we found a stone that's laid up. So it looks very much like a well. And then the other side, the other half of this hole that we found is dolomite. It's like a granite cliff. And we just kept on digging down and down and down. But unfortunately, we had to stop before we could find that actual cavern that was large enough to turn a team of oxen around, because the business ended up going into the building, and there were some health concerns with removing all of that debris. But we did find some geological formations, and we did find a little side cavern, and but there's still a lot of debris that can be removed from the hole.
So now what? You can't get in through that hypothetical entrance. Is there a search for other tunnels that might lead into this?
Well, we've over the years, there's been some construction in and about this area, and so anytime there's a major construction problem with digging, a construction project with digging, we do just kind of monitor the site to see if anything is uncovered. Fortunately, unfortunately, the business that went into this building recently closed. You know, there's always a lot of turnover or turnover in downtowns, and so the building is vacant. And this might be another opportunity to restart the search. We did shoot a short video that shows some of the formations, and so I don't know. I guess it could be a crapshoot, a 50-50 crapshoot, but it seems like we have found enough evidence at least to warrant picking this up again, but we also need some financial backers to do it.
Well, I mean, it sounds really interesting, and there's a lot of mystery there, but is anyone worried that there might be this yawning chasm underneath downtown Ripon?
You know, we never even entered into that discussion. It was just... I think if we find some sort of cavern system, I believe that the number is there's several million people go beneath the ground every year and tour caves. So we looked at it more that this could also be a tourism boon for us. And who knows? I think being able to get further into this geological formation, and then seeing is there any evidence that would point in the direction of the Underground Railroad, that could certainly be another tourist type attraction for our community.
When you talk to people in the downtown area, people in Ripon, are they pretty excited to solve this mystery?
As time goes by, it was more the old timers that would talk about this. So, unfortunately, a lot of the people that we were dealing with were in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and now another decade has gone by since we first started this project. So, we're losing a lot of those resources that we'd first tapped into.
Well, what's next? I mean, you said you've got to raise some more money, but do you have a planned excavation so far? If you get that money,
I think it would be more teamwork to bring in some experts rather than relying on volunteers to do this. So we're the hole is at least 17, 18 feet below the basement floor, so we're probably 20 feet, 20 plus feet below the surface of the surface of the ground. And there's things that we just don't know about. We need better assistance with making sure it's healthy air and that kind of stuff. The last thing we want is to make the news for a tragedy rather than making it for something that could be cool.
Speaking of which, Craig, were you able to go down there with the members of the Speleological Society as far as you could get?
Yeah. Went down, and so they were members of the WSS were able to point out floatstone formations and different types of rock that was down there, and Yes, I shot a little bit of a video. We didn't have iPhones 10 years ago, but took a small video camera down and shot some footage, and we put that onto YouTube.
What was it like being way down under your town there? What did it feel like?
You know, it was a little claustrophobic, and being at the bottom of that cave, anybody who's seen Silence of the Lambs, that's what it was like.
You're really selling us on it, Craig.
Not exactly where you want to have your Prohibition-era drinking party, if you ask me.
Right. I mean, I don't know. It's a cool thing, but yeah, it was a dirty thing because we had to dig the whole thing out by hand.
Wow.
So, well, a very muddy place to work.
Craig, thank you so much for being with us today. And if you solve this anymore, we'll check it out.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
That was Craig Timon, Executive Director of Ripon Main Street Incorporated. I think we got to get the Wisconsin Speleological Society on the show sometime, too. That sounds like a fun thing to talk about.
Yeah, for sure. And don't forget, if you've got an idea for Curious Wisconsin, let us know what your question is, and we'll try to find out the answer for you. You can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as we get ready for week 2 of the NFL season, we'll hear from a guest chef who has some tasty tailgate recipes for the next Packer or Badger game.
We'll also talk to a guest who says technology is changing the way our minds work, and it's a change for the better.
Also, how Wisconsin became a great biking state, despite having only a few months of the year of really great biking weather.
And our news guy Noah Shinsky will be here to recap the state's top news stories. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time. And coming up after the news, we'll talk with a guest who says we all too often attempt to hide our ignorance, and in so many cases, we'd be better off coming off clean. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.